we have an economy that's based on using the sustenance of children, children now and children that are going to be born in the future, to feed the present population, especially the present ruling class. Basically, this is the system of slavery that's been at the heart of all government institutions and economic systems since the beginning.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Lord of America!
I think at this point, anything that they thought they had under their control is long gone. I think at this point it has spiraled out of control, and that the future is wide open.
So not as scary as the last time we talked, but still pretty scary.
Well, look, scary is relative, isn't it? Scary is relative.
That's true.
Because a lot of things have happened since the last time we talked that were scary at the time to think about, and now they've happened, and we're used to it. This is something, like I said, it's bigger than they are. They can't control
right.
it. These are primal forces of nature, and these are hidden patterns of reality that play themselves out in history.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Before we dive into this week's program, first, please allow me to tip my cap and thank the man who provided the theme music for this week's program. His name is Pete Diggins, and his website is www.aurophonic.com. And you spell that AuroPhonic.com. Big, big thanks to you, Pete, for the awesome theme music. We'll be using it here on the program for the next few weeks and months, much like we did with our buddy Ian's tune. And for all those musicians out there who are listening to the program and who may want to contribute a song to a future series of BOA Audio episodes, you can do that by simply writing to boaaudio@hotmail.com. Now, let's get down to business on this week's installment of BOA Audio. It is the long-awaited return to the program of razor-sharp esoteric researcher Tracy Twyman. And this time around, she's going to be talking about her new book, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, which examines the connection between alchemy and economics. Truly some mind-bending stuff here, and it is quite a lengthy conversation. It goes over 2 hours and covers a whole bunch of different stuff. Some of the big tent poles we're going to be covering are not just this alchemical economic connection, but also the current state of the economic crisis and what's going on in the economy today and where things may be headed. In the discussion on alchemics, as Tracy calls it, we'll find out how alchemical ideas seem to form the basis for key elements of our current economic system. We'll learn about concepts like the Golden Age of Saturn, the Lord of the Earth, and specifically how child sacrifice plays a key role in both ancient alchemy and our current world. Along the way, of course, we're going to journey down some side roads that include the technology of ancient civilizations, the potential for human organs to be used as economic instruments, 2012, and, as always, tons and tons more. Much like when other guests make their BOA Audio return, this episode goes from interview to conversation to jam session over the course of these 2+ hours. So strap yourself in and get ready for a fascinating and wild ride. Altogether, really, it is a mind-bending edition of the program that strives to glimpse at the true underpinnings that influence our world with one of the sharpest minds in esoterica today, Tracy Twyman. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Tracy Twyman, allow me to provide you with a little background on her. Tracy Twyman has been writing about alternative history and the occult for 14 years. She's the author of The Merovingian Mythos, Solomon's Treasure, and Mind Control, Sex Slaves, and the CIA. She's also the former editor of Dagobert's Revenge magazine, a journal of esoteric history that was published from 1996 to 2003. Her latest book is Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, And you can find out more about her at www.tracyrtwyman.com, TracyRTwyman.com. And there you can find out more about her books and read a whole bunch of articles by Tracy Twyman dealing with the emerging police state, the current financial crisis, and a whole bunch of other cool alchemical topics. And with all that said, let's get down to business, my friends, and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on March 20th, 2011. Tracy Twyman talking about the connection between alchemy and the economy on BOA Audio Season 6. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Really excited to be bringing back our guest this week, Tracy Twyman. She was on the program back in season 4, and, you know, we talk about a lot of weird stuff on here on this program. We talk a lot about some scary stuff, but she talks about some insanely scary material that is real, real scary stuff, because it's really what's going on in the world right now with the economy and really the roots of all these problems we're dealing with. And in a lot of ways, as I said, that stuff is a lot scarier than aliens and Bigfoot and stuff like that. So I enjoyed it quite a bit when we talked the first time around. I know a lot of the listeners did as well, because they've been clamoring for her return to the program, which is what we're doing here this week on the show. She has just put out a new book. It's in ebook form, and I think she may be sort of reissuing it as an expanded edition. We'll find out about that in a moment. It's called Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, and it is some compelling stuff. It is really thought-provoking and really eye-opening to me. So I'm excited to explore some of the concepts that she puts forward in the book. And really, having read this and having read a lot of her previous stuff, I gotta say, folks, she is one of the sharpest cookies in the esoteric field, genre for genre, let's say. You know, she is just so well-versed in so many really finer details and arcane details with regards to a whole bunch of stuff that it amazes me. And as I was saying to her before we started the show here, I'd have to read this book 5 or 6 times before I could be as quick as she is with these details and this information. So I'm going to do my best to keep up with her, and I'm going to make her slow down for all of us. Don't worry, guys. Anyway, I could ramble all day because I'm very excited to have her on the show. Tracy Twyman, welcome back to BOA Audio. Let's dig on in.
Oh, thank you so much, Tim. It's nice to be on again.
I guess, well, we had you on a couple of years ago. Let's just sort of do a catch-up. What have you been up to in the last couple of years, aside obviously from the new book here? You know, what's been going on with Tracy Twyman since, 2009?
Well, really, I've been immersing myself in research. And, you know, the last time we talked, I had just really started re-immersing myself in economics, because at that time we were right in the throes of the crash of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written a book previously to that discussion called Solomon's Treasure, where I was examining the what I call the alchemical nature of our economy, which is which utilizes fiat currency, which is, you know, money created out of nothing by banks with the sanction of government. And you know, at that time we were talking about comparisons between that process of creating money out of nothing and alchemy. And you know, we talked about symbols on the dollar bill that sort of point to alchemical concepts and,
mm-hmm.
and the dollar sign itself. And, you know, so anyway, yeah, we were talking about what was going on back then. I had decided that I was going to re-explore the concept of economic alchemy, or as I call it, alchemonics.
Ah, oh, I like that. Nice.
And, you know, so over the last couple of years since we last talked, I've been, you know, following current events, which is, of course, overwhelming. Everything we talked about in 2008 has just, you know, gotten worse. We were describing the situation then of what seemed like impending hyperinflation, currency collapse, and, of course, just collapse of financial systems in general, potential debt defaults by governments.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I think the audience may have felt like it was a bit alarmist. You know, we were, of course, in the throes of a big financial collapse. But everyone, all the authorities were telling us that, you know, if you just bail out the banks in a couple months, everything's going to be fine. And, you know, I think we were predicting several years of turmoil and doom. And, you know, I was talking about the, like I said, the possibility of governments literally defaulting on their debt and, you know, what might be the fallout of that. And that's all been happening.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, we're sort of like, you know, picking up where we had left off almost a couple of years ago. We're still here, though. We're still standing, Tracy. You and I are still, you know, we're not like destitute or on the streets, as far as I know. So I know I'm not, and you're doing all right. So, I mean, is the worst?
No, I'm not doing all right, and I don't know if you are.
No, I'm not doing great, but I mean, you know, I'm hanging in there.
Well, okay, yeah, we're still breathing. It's not like, you know, I guess Ireland or Iceland. These are governments that have defaulted, and well, there's a difference between Ireland and Iceland. Iceland decided not to repay the banks the full amount that they were demanding, or it was not even repay. They were demanding basically to be completely bailed out of the consequences of their own actions, their own, you know, bad investments. And Iceland said no, and, you know, they went through a period of difficulty getting cheap imports and things like that, because their currency was weak. Their bonds weren't considered high rate for a while, but they bounced back pretty quickly. They're getting better. Ireland, Greece, and some of these other countries have accepted austerity measure requirements from the IMF. The IMF is this international, like just like the Federal Reserve, really. It's kind of it's the international agency, I guess, appointed mainly by Anglo-American bankers in the beginning, you know, creating this thing. And it attempts to control all of the different currencies around the world that participate in this international currency system, of which the dollar is supposed to be the reserve currency, although that's starting to change. And at any rate, when countries start to have problems with their with the value of their currency, they have problems paying their bondholders for their treasury debt, the IMF will come in and tell them how they need to change things in order to, you know, get their fiscal house in order.
Yeah.
And they're literally, they boss them around. They act like they own the place. And they tell them, you have to, usually this is what they do with austerity measures. They come in and they say, you have to lower public expenditures. And in Europe, you know, so much of the domestic economy is based on that. So many people work for the government or are receiving benefits from the government and dependent on them.
Yeah.
Well, the IMF will come in and tell them, you have to immediately lower that considerably and raise taxes on everyone. And so that's why, you know, all of a sudden the rug gets pulled out from under you if you're in Greece or Ireland. And that's why they're rioting in the streets, or have been. And, you know, that's why they are facing a very difficult future if they don't, I don't know, overthrow their governments, do something to it's literally happening, you know, as we
that's
speak
true,
right now.
That's true, yeah. Well, I mean, is it going to get worse for us? I mean, I feel for the Irish and the Greek people and all that, but what about us Americans? Is the worst yet to come still?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The collapse of the dollar, or, you know, it's going to, what's happening is it's being relegated to just another currency as opposed to being the, you know,
the standard,
the make-believe gold that is at the heart of the whole international alchemical system. The dollar was made to function as good as gold. In other words, originally there was this Bretton Woods agreement. It was an international currency agreement between the central banks of all these different countries that they would use the dollar is their reserve currency, and what that means is that they would hold it in their own central banks as backing for their own currencies, as if it was gold. That's the role that gold used to play in the global economy prior to World War II. And after the World War II, they made this agreement that they would pretend that the dollar, which is printed out of nothing by the government, by the United States government, or by the Federal Reserve, which isn't really the government. At any rate, you know, this thing that's printed out of nothing, that's alchemically created through magic, is taking the place of gold in the international currency.
Uh-huh.
And so when they need to redeem those well, okay, when they want to turn it into something that's valuable to them, we used to have an agreement that they could redeem those dollars for gold. And at a certain point in the 70s, Nixon decided to change that. We were running out of gold. Everyone was turning in their dollars for gold because their dollars were starting to become worthless. You know, we were having an expansion of major inflation at that point. And that's when Nixon decided he was just going to tell everyone that, no, you can't redeem your dollars for gold anymore. Now dollars just, they have no relationship to gold, technically. You know, they're free-floating. So at any rate, I'm just describing how, you know, dollars have been the artificial gold of the system for a long time. And it's getting to the point now where a lot of countries don't want to have that sort of burden to deal with. Because what's really happening is, in order to maintain the dollar's status, and it has to maintain a certain value, you know, within the international markets, they have to tweak all these other indices in order to maintain that. And the government and the Federal Reserve and some banks, including J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, are involved in tweaking all of these indices behind the scenes to try to maintain the value of the dollar. And there's so much relationship, really, between that and current events. It just so happens that so many times when there's a military invasion or some important, you know, thing that happens in the news, it turns out that it just so happens to work to the advantage of the United States and the value of the U.S. dollar. And, you know, it'd be kind of laborious to go through them all, but it's easy to, you can talk about 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. And the maintaining the value of oil is very important, or the relationship, the price relationship between oil and dollars. There's sort of an implied backing there. That's why they're called petrodollars. You know, that's the value of, that's the value in dollars of the oil that's being held by these oil-producing countries. And when oil goes high, when it costs a lot of dollars to buy oil, then, you know, that's when you can say that the value of the dollar is really, really starting to decline. So back when we were talking in 2008, we were in this period where gas, I guess it had finally started to go down a little bit, but we had just gone through this summer of just insane gas prices. And I'm sure you remember sort of the ripple effect that happened there, where everything then was affected because the price of fuel is really the basis of everything else. You know, you have to, in order to get goods around the world, you have to be able to fuel the
people. Yeah, transport them and everything else, yeah.
So, you know, that's, you know, a lot of people worry about peak oil, and that's the issue there, is if oil gets too expensive to take out of the ground and refine, then, you know, everything else starts to break down. It's like no longer economically worth it to, you know, bring goods, say, for instance, on a truck all the way across a continent, or to even in some cases fly them or ship them on a boat across oceans. I mean, right now our economy is so based on international commerce. And if you think about it, there's just some amazing things going on right now. Like sometimes if you go to the supermarket, you'll buy some apples, right? Those apples may have been grown, you know, in the United States, or they may have been grown in Mexico or something, but then they'll be shipped to China where they get waxed by, you know, Chinese corporate slaves working for pennies a day. And then they ship them all the way back here to sell them to us. And if you think about how much an apple is, you know, not very much money usually, and how it was somehow profitable to someone to go through all of that, and how much fuel was spent doing that. You know, and that's happening everywhere. Like if you buy a product, so many times there'll be, you know, the item itself was made in China, and then it might be brought here or somewhere else to go do something else to the item, and then they might ship it back to China to package it, and then they finally ship it to Mexico where it's put on a truck and driven by a Mexican truck driver up the NAFTA superhighway and to deliver to American Walmarts. And, you know, somehow that's profitable. The reason why it's profitable is really because of the relationship that the U.S. dollar has to all these other currencies, it's the whole global supply chain and international currency markets are being manipulated to make this happen. So the goal of the Bretton Woods Agreement, and the creation of the World Trade Organization, all that happened at the same time. They said that the goal was to create the most efficient global supply chain that you could have. You know, they have like this mathematical formula that they're trying to meet, where everything can be produced and sold and distributed in the most efficient way. And, you know, that includes trying to get the price of human labor down as much as possible relative to the dollar. So that's why, you know, it's complicated, but when you look at the history of all of these international economic policy decisions that have been made since the 40s, you can see that they've deliberately or engineered it the way it is now, and the way it is now is so dependent on being able to ship these goods all over the world with very little cost. And, you know, if you can't do that, then, well, you know, it's not like the world's going to end. It's just that it has to change, adjust to that. You know, you got to have more domestic production and stuff like that.
Oh, Tracy, you're always scaring me on here with these...
What?
Dark outlook on the... Why can't they just grow the apples in America and sell them? Who needs them waxed?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Well, you know, maybe
well, I don't even
wax, but, you know...
Can't we wax them? Oh, man. We're going to eventually.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what's going to happen? It's going to end up like, you know, we're just going to stop being able to ship things all over the place and just start making them here because it's cheaper to make it here?
Well, here's one thing that I think has changed since the last time we talked.
Okay.
I was very pessimistic in general last time we talked, as in, you know, the fix is in. You know, there's no way out of just descending into economic slavery, descending into everyone, you know, everyone's currency collapsing, everyone living in a depression, and everyone being indebted to banks and governments to the point where they're just miserable debt slaves. And that's still, you know, a potential future, very, very much a potential future.
Okay.
But what's happening now is that, you know, people are becoming aware of what's happening around them. Also, more people with money, with wealth, people in positions of power are waking up to it as well and, you know, not necessarily wanting to go along with it. And whereas I would say that in 2008 we were dealing with what someone's idea of a managed collapse. I think, you know, it was all part of a process to try to wean us into a different international currency system, one with a real international currency produced by the IMF, the SDR, as they call it, not the dollar. And so I really think that, you know, and not to sound too conspiratorial, but, you know, these things can be very easily controlled from the top by central banks colluding with governments. Well, banks colluding with governments through central banks, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
But it's like, I really think that, you know, this thing has been engineered, not every single step of the way, but in a broad sense, since the 40s, and to try to bring the whole world into an international currency system with the dollar, and then wean them off the dollar and, you know, remake it yet again.
Into a unified, like a one world dollar.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, I think that the people who were doing that, you know, I'm sure they had some sort of ideology where they can justify it as they think that they're helping everyone. The justification of Bretton Woods and everything, all the international agreements that happened at that time were that they were going to prevent another world war from happening. That if you can make everyone economically mutually interdependent, that means that any sort of war or even trade war that you allow to break out would be mutually destructive, which is why even though, you know, there is sort of a trade war happening between the U.S. and China, neither one of them wants the other to collapse fully because, you know, China owns a whole bunch of our bonds. They don't want them to become worthless. And, you know, we want them to keep buying our bonds, so we want them to have a healthy economy. And that was the goal of that was the so-called good reason behind Bretton Woods. And, you know, but at the same time, what it really is people who are already in positions of power and have lots of money trying to use that money and power to consolidate their wealth and make it easier to manage and get more of it. And so, you know, those are the people, those are the elite moneyed families that, you know, just like the conspiracy theorists say, they've been behind everything for some time now, behind the manipulation of currencies and governments.
Wow.
And now, anyway, at that time, I thought that we were in a collapse that was being caused and managed. Well, I think at this point, anything that they thought they had under their control is long gone. I think at this point it has spiraled out of control, and that the future is wide open. In other words, we are seeing social revolutions happen right now, and who knows what's going to come of that. But it could be entirely different from the world order that we had before.
All right. We need like a world revolution against this economic system, which is sort of to dig into the book here, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge. You introduced some sort of big ideas here to what we're seeing going on in the world, I guess is the best way to put it. And that's not even very well put. You introduced some interesting ideas that I never really considered or had thought of. You sort of like do a really good job of stepping outside of the workaday bubble to explain how the very economy by which, you know, we all participate is, as you like to say, sort of alchemical, has alchemical roots to it, has a lot of strange alchemy going on. And what I thought was really, well, I guess before we sort of dig into the big meat of the book, why don't you sort of summarize, I guess you could say, the main idea behind Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge.
Okay, well, I am taking my study of alchemics, the alchemical nature of the fiat currency economy, and actually the alchemical nature of just the history of money in general, mm-hmm. Taking it to another level and exploring specifically the alchemical process itself, the steps in that process, and how they are in some ways analogous to things that are happening in the global economy. I'm making metaphors, but in alchemy, it really utilizes a lot of metaphors harkening back to, you know, different ancient mythologies. In the Bible and in Greek mythology, they draw a lot from that. And these alchemical manuscripts, the source of the whole body of knowledge of alchemy, written in medieval times and early, up to, I would say, early Renaissance times, they're written in really dense code. And I would say that I don't trust anyone who claims that they've decoded them or any one of them. I think that, you know, they're written in such code that almost no one has decoded them. And if they have, they haven't published it, you know.
Yeah.
But I had my own crack at it with this recent study I did for the book. And what I found was that they seem to be talking about, okay, there's these two things. There's mercury and there's lead in the process of alchemy, they say. And these are, they say that they're not just the regular metals. You know, it's a metaphor for something deeper. Yes, it is the metal, but it's also, it has another layer or several other layers of meaning to it.
Yeah.
The original alchemists were, you know, that's the origin of chemistry. That's the origin of metallurgy. It came out of these mystically minded people doing metaphysical studies with the properties of metals and other chemicals. And so at the time that they were doing this, anything having to do with science and the transformation of substances from one to the other and the different properties of them was considered mystical, and they were sort of thought of as, you know, almost kind of like witches. I mean, there weren't as many persecutions of alchemists, I would say, as there were of witches, but they were sort of thought of by the community as, you know, people dabbling in a dangerous subject. And you really can compare alchemy to ritual magic. I would say that it's pretty much the same thing. Hermeticism is the study of alchemy. Hermes is, you know, the patron saint of alchemy. And Hermes, that's the Greek name for this god. The Roman name is Mercury. And the substance mercury is named after him and thought of in the alchemical process as being analogous. These things are connected. You know, the metal mercury is the god Mercury, and it is also this really difficult to explain abstract concept of the principle that changes one thing into another.
Yeah, like a changing agent.
Right, right. It's the alchemists thought of themselves as learning the secrets of God's creation. And, you know, they believed that God brought something out of nothing, created the universe, and transformed the primal chaos of the universe into the different things that we see today. And that he used this universal agent, this God force, as, the power in order to do that. The transformative power. And the alchemists were basically saying that the mercury is that. And the mercury extracts the gold from the lead. The lead is thought of as analogous to the primal materia, the primal chaos. And so they use this metaphor of the mercury as this child being swallowed and then reborn. And specifically one of the alchemists, Nicholas Flamel, he wrote a treatise about alchemy, and there's these seven images inside of it that have always fascinated people who study alchemy. They've never really understood what they mean. You know, people are always trying to figure it out. But one of the images in there is of Saturn cutting off the feet of Mercury. And then it talks – oh, and then there's another image, actually, not in the book necessarily, but on Nicholas Flamel's property, of Herod ordering the slaying of the innocents, you know, all the babies that were killed when Christ was born, because mm-hmm. he was trying to eliminate Jesus. Because there was a prophecy that Jesus was going to grow up to be the Messiah and overthrow him. Well, Nicholas Flamel says that story is really harkening back to the story of Saturn or Cronos and his children. So the story of Cronos is that he had overthrown his father, who had been the main god in the world at that time, Uranus. And he did so by castrating him, and then he imprisoned him in the center of the earth. And then Cronos became the lord of the earth. And he ruled over this golden age where supposedly the earth was in this paradisal realm. There was no time. There was no bad weather. Nobody had to work for a living. And he was thought of as the Lord of Misrule. In other words, he was the king, but he wasn't telling people what to do. There was no need for that.
Right. There's no laws or anything like that.
Right. Everything was perfect. But the bad thing that Cronus was guilty of was killing all of his children, because he thought that there was a prophecy that he was going to be overthrown by one of his sons, just as he had overthrown his own father. And so, you can see the analogy here to the story of Herod. And so, and the massacre of the innocents. So the way that Cronos killed his children was by swallowing them. As soon as his wife, Rhea, would give birth to a child, he would have her deliver it to him, and then he would eat it. And in the Greek myth, these divine children were still alive in some sort of semi, you know, dreamlike state inside of his stomach. And Rhea, his wife, at one point she just got sick of having all of her children killed. She decided one of them she was going to save. So she saved Zeus and brought him to the island of Crete surreptitiously. Instead of giving Zeus to her husband to swallow, she gave him a stone. And then Zeus grew up on Crete. He was raised by a goat, and when he grew up, he slaughtered the goat and he turned its hide into his shield, the magical Aegis. That, you know, anyway, that's one of the things that Zeus has always seen, with his magic Aegis shield. And so Zeus then, you know, grew up and did exactly what was prophesied. He became the cupbearer to his father's throne. Surreptitiously, his dad didn't know who he was. And then he gave him something to drink, and it had some poison in it, and that caused Cronos to vomit out all of his children. And those were the Olympian gods. They came out of his stomach. So did the stone, and the stone became the Omphalos stone that they worshipped at the Oracle of Delphi. But at any rate, so the Olympian gods came out of the stomach of Cronos, and then Zeus and the other Olympian gods fought against Cronos and his kingdom and overtook it. And so now, supposedly, we're living still in the realm of Zeus. And Zeus is analogous to the god of the Bible. He's similar to Jehovah. So
let me jump in here, Tracy, and sort of rein it in a little bit and sort of I'll sort of set you up a little bit more here on this. I think the point you're trying to make in the book is that there's this tradition of child sacrifice that dates back to the ancient times that was then sort of co-opted and interpreted on their own by the alchemists. And the end result really is that this machine, this economic machine that we're all a part of, is at the very core using child sacrifice in a metaphorical sense to power the whole machine.
Yeah, yeah. The alchemists were saying that, you know, in alchemy, the lead, the Saturn, is eating his children, the metals, and then digesting them, because the Athanor of the alchemists was thought of as a stomach. And then, I mean, they literally said that. And then, you know, then what would come out of the Athanor is the gold, or whatever the end result is of the transformation. And yeah, in, you can carry this analogy forward to the economy. I was saying that, yeah, we have an economy that's based on using the sustenance of children now and children that are going to be born in the future, to feed the present population, especially the present ruling class. And in the book, I go through a whole bunch of different stories, not only ancient myths, but also more recent folk legends and things like that, where it's the same pattern of the king forces his subjects to kill their children and turn them into gold and then give the gold to him. And I basically analyze culture in general, the myths of several different cultures throughout history, and the economy, and said, look, this child sacrifice is really the main central mystery, the main rite at the heart of the ritual of statecraft. And in the economy, yeah, I'll explain what I mean by that it's based on the sustenance of the future, the children of the future. Here's how it goes. The government is creating this money out of nothing, and in order to back it, they're selling bonds to the public or to other central banks, other private banks, you know, they're just selling bonds, right?
Yeah.
And so someone is holding this thing that has alleged value. Well, where does the value come from? It comes from the government's right to tax its citizens. So when the government is selling bonds to create money, they are selling to the bondholder their ownership of you, mm-hmm. your present and future labor and your wealth and everything that you will possess and produce throughout your life. But because governments love to work mainly in deficit, you know, they always borrow more than they can pay back. They always need to spend more than they have with tax revenue. So what they end up doing really is putting on the hook not only you in your present life for tax expenditures, but also your children and their children. And if we're at the point now where, you know, every family owes allegedly $50,000 or more of the debt. You know, the figure changes depending on which report you're looking at. But, you know, and there's no way that Social Security could possibly last for another generation. In fact, Social Security is another example of this. Social Security, the average person who's using it now and who has used it in the past, is getting approximately 8 times the value that they put into it. And that's a value that's not dollars, that's adjusted for inflation.
Oh, wow.
So that means that they're, you know, using the Saturn analogy, you know, every geezer on Social Security and Medicare is getting, he's swallowing like 8 of his children in order to get that, you know. Those are kids that will have to work their whole lives, presumably, and get taxed at an enormous rate. And their money will have so little value because of the inflation that's been created that, you know, they're just going to be miserable slaves, and there's no way that they're going to be able to get any of these Social Security benefits or health care or anything like that. And, you know, that's what our current economy is based on. It's very easy to see the analogy in the present economy. It's more arcane, actually, when you look at older economic systems, but it's there, trust me. This is the system of slavery that's been at the heart of all government institutions and economic systems since the beginning. And you know, I guess one of the reasons why I went into such detail about the Golden Age and the life of Saturn is because I think it's a really interesting concept. The Golden Age was really, it's like the Garden of Eden, it really seems to be this timeless realm. This is before time began, you know, mythologically.
Yeah.
And the reason really why Cronus had to swallow his children back then was because that would have initiated the process of time. You know, if you have birth, you have to have death. And Cronus ruled in paradise so long as there was no actual time. I mean, they even said that in the Golden Age, the year was 360 days long, and the orbit of the Earth was a perfect circle. The axis was not tilted, and therefore there were no seasons. Everything was the same all year round. And as long as you lived in this third of the planet around the equator, you were in this perfect paradise realm. And so, you know, even though it's so hard to imagine timelessness, you know, but that's what these mythographers seem to have been trying to communicate.
Yeah.
And so it's just this really, I think, really interesting way of looking at things, and I've been doing way more research on the Golden Age even since the printing of my newest book, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, and I'm more and more convinced that this is really an not understood concept in mythology, and also in hermetics, religious rituals today that people don't understand. And then I do think that there's this belief amongst secret societies nowadays that we are going back into a new Golden Age, because that's part of the whole prophecy, is that that there's these four epochs of man. The Golden Age was the first, and then there were these others that all named after metals, mind you. And they actually said that the human beings of those periods were made out of these different metals. So, like, in the Golden Age, there were actually golden people, and now we're in the Iron Age, supposedly. Don't get confused about the archaeological terms of, you know, Iron Age and Bronze Age.
Yeah,
and all
yeah.
That. It's not the same. But at any rate, so they say we're going through these different eons of time, and that they repeat in a cycle. So, you know, eventually, supposedly, we're going to have a new Golden Age again. But during the Iron Age, which is what we're in right now, society's breaking down. Everything's collapsing. Mankind is corrupt, and, you know, every man for himself, everyone screwing each other over. And, you know, it's hard to say that's not happening. But the prediction is that eventually that gives way, that the child, you know, of the present aeon dies and is reborn. Then we're in some new Golden Age in which, you know, it's said that it's a realm of peaceful anarchy. Now, and it's strange to think of Saturn, you know, this person eating, or God eating his own children, as being a good guy, but that's sort of the image, is that, well, he was the king of this wonderful time in history, or time of no time, I guess. And so the hat that he wore, the red Phrygian cap, as it's called. It's the same as Santa Claus's hat without the little ball at the end. And Santa Claus is absolutely based on Saturn. But Saturn, yeah, was thought of as this benevolent king, and the hat is associated with libertarianism. The Liberty Cap, which I named my one of my websites after, libertycappress.com.
Yeah.
It's associated with revolution and equality and freedom. And so it's interesting to think that we may be coming into a new golden age, and that it's not something that the elites necessarily are controlling, although they may be trying to, but they couldn't. You know, if it's a force of history that's, you know, more powerful than they are,
they may just be trying to keep it from happening,
regardless of what they try to do. So it's interesting to try to think of what may be coming next, you know?
It's always interesting to think about what may be coming next. I think that's what drives a lot of us here in this odd little field that we're in. We take the time to stop and try and contemplate that. Speaking of time, I thought it was interesting. You really make some interesting points in the book about time and how it's sort of become commodified in, you know, the last two or three generations, if you will, you know, on purpose. And I found that really interesting because a lot of people don't consider that, but you know, you sort of make the point in the book that, you know, when you're working at a job or something like that, you're really selling your time to your employer, and it's that time equals money, as the expression goes, in a literal sense. So I guess talk about that sort of idea there, that the commodification of time.
Sure. Yeah. I pointed out that without a gold standard, you have this implicit connection between time and money, where everyone's money, the value of their money, is measured by labor, by how many minimum wage man hours you can get out of that amount of money. But because, of course, the value of the dollar fluctuates, and it always, well, fluctuate is the wrong term. I mean, over the period of a month or more, it's always going to be going down. And that's what's been going on for decades now. So when that happens, when they inflate the currency by printing more dollars than there are presently goods and services to absorb it or back it up, then that waters down the value of those man hours. So what I pointed out is that does something to the psyche of the person doing the work, that as time goes on, it seems like time is going faster, you know, that you have to work more and more in order to maintain a certain level of standard of living. So, you know, I'm sure there's a certain point, I know I reached it, where you can't possibly do any more things in the day, and yet the money that you're getting isn't worth what you need to buy in order to live. You
right.
know? And so, yeah, I just talked about how that's sort of a mystical alchemical concept. And here you have Saturn or Cronos being the father time figure. And in the alchemical metaphor, they talk about him cutting off the feet of Mercury. This is a state, something that happens in the alchemical process. Mercury is, the metal is liquid at room temperature. But, you know, when you do certain things to it or change the temperature of it, then it will solidify. And so I think that's what they were talking about, was combining mercury and lead and whatever metals they happen to be using in whatever transformation you happen to be doing at the time. But the effect is that it solidifies the mercury. It cuts its feet off. It prevents mercury from flying. Mercury has wings on his hat, and he can normally fly, but if you fix his feet to the ground or cut them off, or in some of the pictures, Saturn is tying his feet up, then you're preventing him from being free, basically. And so, yeah, I was saying that that's sort of an image of what's happened to modern man, the slavery that we now have, you know, where we're indebted to the point where we have to sell all of the time that we have and then more. but that relationship of Saturn to Mercury, where Saturn's cutting off the feet of Mercury, is really an emblem of modern man living in a world where time equals money, but there isn't enough time to pay for everything.
Ain't that the truth?
and I think if we got time left, I'd like
we
to
got plenty of time. We got plenty of time.
I'd like to say some things about Christmas.
Wow. Okay. This comes out of nowhere. All right.
No. It's part of the. Well, I talked about it in the book. How Christmas is this very important time in the economy. That you know, everyone, the economy operates in the red, really. You know, for most of the year, and then on
Black
Friday,
back.
The day after Thanksgiving, that's when the whole Christmas shopping season kicks off, and that's when retailers expect to finally make their money back and make a profit.
Yeah.
And so much of our economy domestically is really dependent on this consumer purchasing, and so much of it happens during this period that when, you know, if people did not participate in this festival, it wouldn't work at all.
Right.
And there's so many things going on there. You know, you're working. Well, okay.
No, it sounds like you're ready to unload here, so go for it.
No, there's so many different directions I could go in, but I think we have to start with the connection between Santa Claus and Kronos. I mean, Kronos is the basis of Santa Claus. In Rome, they called this festival Saturnalia. And they celebrated it on the last days of the year. Remember I said that during Saturn's kingdom in the Golden Age, there were 360 days.
Right.
And it's corresponding with the 360 degrees of the circle, and everything was perfect and wonderful. And then something happened, some sort of cataclysm happened that marked the transition from that age to the next. You can think of that as being analogous to Zeus overthrowing Kronos. That caused the axis to be tilted and the orbit to be changed. So it's 365 days and some change now instead of 360.
Right.
And so in the ancient world, not only in Rome, but in Egypt and several other, I'm pretty sure Babylon, they had this concept that the last 5 days of the year were non-days. They didn't actually exist because they remembered the older time, you know, and they always thought of that as the sacred time period, you know, that this is a fallen version of the old world, the old reality. And so during the last 5 days of the year, it'd just be a festival. They would celebrate. And in Roman Saturnalia, this is the way they did it, was they would let all of the slaves free for a few days, and they would all put on that red liberty cap to signify that they were free, and everyone was allowed to drink and use prostitutes and gamble and all of these things that were considered uncouth and something you shouldn't do in public during the rest of the year. At any rate, so yeah, Saturnalia, anciently, historically, is this time period of celebration. Of the Golden Age. You try to recreate the Golden Age. And one of the things that would happen is they would have this temporary king elected. Here's how they elect them. They still do this at Mardi Gras, by the way. They have these things called king cakes. And you bake a cake with a little token inside representing a baby. And you cut up the cake, and whoever gets the slice with the baby hidden inside of it is the king for the Saturnalia festival, and he gets treated like the king throughout the entire time, and he's given gifts, and then he also distributes gifts to children, just like Santa Claus.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the festival, he is sacrificed, or in some cases, he's the king from last year's Saturnalia, and then he finally gets sacrificed, and then they elect a new one. So that's where we get this. So many of our rituals from the Saturnalia festival. Why do you set out cookies for Santa Claus? It's a votive offering, basically, to Kronos to keep him from eating your children. Seriously, that's the origin of it.
Yeah.
And so anyway, Christmas. It's so weird to think of it that it's this important period at the end of the year that our economy depends on people making ridiculous purchases, supposedly giving gifts to their children. Supposedly it's all about the children. But at the heart of it is this symbolism from the ancient world of child sacrifice, and not only that, but eating the children. So, it's very interesting to think about, I think.
Yeah, very interesting. So we've established that you hate Christmas.
No.
I was just joking,
I love
Tracy.
Christmas. It's really weird. It's so weird. I love it.
All right. Okay. So you love Christmas, even though it's based on child sacrifice. You can't win on this. No, I'm just teasing you, Tracy. What I find interesting is sort of what we've been talking about here and is, you know, talked about at length in the book, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, is that, you know, we seem like this sophisticated society and, you know, we don't sacrifice children anymore or, you know, in most civilized parts of the world. But really, we're still sort of enacting a lot of these ritual aspects that have been going on since ancient times. It's very strange. And you wonder, I guess, you know, who – clearly you've, you know, unlocked this, if it's all, you know, accurate, let's say. You know, as you said, you do your own interpretations, obviously. But you wonder, you know, if these families or whatever, if they're sort of – if they understand that all of this is ritual. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I think that – yeah, the more elite families absolutely do. And then as far as everyone else goes, you know, this is something, like I said, it's bigger than they are. They can't control
right.
it. These are primal forces of nature, and these are hidden patterns of reality that they play themselves out in history, but you don't really see the pattern until later, you know?
Yeah.
I'm trying to describe the pattern as I see it going on right now. That's nothing compared to what it'll be like 10 years from now, when we look back at this period in time and see, you know, what was really going on, we can see so many more patterns, so many more metaphors to be made. But child sacrifice, you know, that's the prime religious ritual of all. You know, you think about it, that's what Jesus was all about. It was God demanding the sacrifice of his own son in the stead of us, of his other children, the humans. And that not only child sacrifice, but the concept of the substitution of that it's possible to sort of placate God by offering a substitute. That's so common, you know, Abraham was going to sacrifice Isaac to God, but then God accepted a goat sacrifice instead, or a ram. And then at the Passover, that's what is really going on there. You're sacrificing the ram instead of the firstborn sons of Israel. And you know, it's just that's if you just go back to the ancient world, that's what it's all about, is
right.
child sacrifice. And if you can't actually sacrifice your son, you do it to someone else's son, or you know, in later times, then they started using animals, and now we use little cookies. You know, you consume the flesh and blood of God, but it's only a metaphorical God hidden in a cookie.
Yeah, but as you also point out in the book, what we're also doing, I don't have any kids, thank God, but what other people are also doing is they're sacrificing their children to the machine, to the whole system now. You know, you teach your kid to go to school and to work and the value of the dollar and all that horse shit. You know, and then really it's a big con. It's a big system that's been set up.
The metaphor of the Matrix is really applies here, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
If you just remember that movie, I mean, it's a cheesy movie, but it's got some really interesting concepts in it. And one of them is that if you're one of the victims, if you're one of the slaves, one of the batteries for the machine of the future, you're literally like floating in a vat of goo being digested. But you're not aware of it because you're dreaming this alternate reality. But meanwhile, your body and the sustenance of your body is being utilized by this machine slave owner that you're not even aware of. And interestingly, in that movie, they said that the slaves, the people that were floating around in this goo, what did they eat? What was their sustenance? It was the liquefied remains of the other slaves. So it was cannibalistic as well.
Well, I also was thinking about this as I read the book, too. This is sort of a chicken or an egg thing, maybe. And I don't know, you didn't really get into this in the book, so I don't know if this has crossed your mind yet or not. But, you know, we talk about the children and babies being used, you know, in the alchemical practices and whatnot, and child sacrifice. And you wonder, how this might lead somewhere towards stem cell research. And I wonder if perhaps either it was that quest to sacrifice babies that led to that knowledge, or if it was lost knowledge originally that led to the misconception that power could be derived from babies.
I don't know. I mean, I've definitely thought of it.
I stumped you this time. Nice.
No, you haven't stumped me, not necessarily. I mean, I didn't get into this much yet in this interview, but I did talk about how not only do I think that there's a metaphor there in alchemy, many layers of metaphor that can be applied to many different things, but I think that, you know, the some of the alchemists in some of the time were actually using the remains of children. And I talked about how, you know, I thought definitely that Nicholas Flamel might have been doing that, he and his wife, because he and his wife did their alchemy together. He always sort of alluded, he always said that, well, my wife's participation is really important. I couldn't have done it without her. And one of the interesting things about them is that when they got their first, I guess, load of riches made from gold, you know, from surreptitiously creating gold through the alchemical process, they became wealthy, and then they needed to, you know, launder that, I guess. They needed to put it into things in order, you know, for everyone to not wonder, hey, what's that pile of gold sitting over there? So at any rate, it's also sort of a spiritual concept that it's important to donate your wealth to good causes because that brings more wealth. That's another alchemical monetary concept that I've written about in other books. But at any rate, so one of the things he wanted to do was, you know, he wanted to do some sort of good work. And so he created this cemetery by his house where babies that had died during birth or shortly thereafter could be buried, and also, you know, children that had miscarried. So that he called it the Cemetery of the Innocents, and he put that image of Herod and the Massacre of the Innocents right on the outside of it. And it was right by his house. So I thought, you know, this is probably not a coincidence, and if you think about it, isn't it quite likely that Flamel was using the remains of some of those children in some of his operations? And isn't it quite possible that his wife could have been producing some of this material as well? You know, she could have had some pregnancies that were deliberately terminated early so that the material could be used.
Right.
And, you know, at that time, that would have been one of the most horrible things you could do. I mean, having an abortion and especially deliberately doing it for such a purpose would have been so diabolical, you know.
Well, it's still pretty diabolical. You know, it's certainly not something that's encouraged nowadays either.
Absolutely. No, I agree with you. I mean, I'm not in favor of abortion at all, and, you know, I won't get into that. But
No. I just mean, you know, abortion for the sake of having the ingredients for some kind of weird magical ritual.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It would be weird today, and absolutely the sort of thing that you would get stoned over back then. So, but in his writing, he sort of hints at it, but then he says, but I wouldn't use the real blood of children in the operations because that would be diabolical. But then he later talks about basically having a guilty conscience. So I really got the idea that he was using the remains of children and that he was doing these good works as a way of sort of making up for that. So then you think about modern times and the use of stem cells and things like that. Of course, the only reason why that hasn't progressed further is because it's considered bad, you know, there's a taboo.
Right.
And, if you think about it, if it wasn't for our moral standards that we presently have, most people have, you know, some sort of a Judeo-Christian moral standard, that would be happening so much more. In fact, I've theorized in the past about the use of human body parts as a economic basis. And my father's name is Rich and Famous.
What's that?
And My father's name is rich and famous. That's his name. And
what does that mean?
That's actually he changed his name. It's sort of a stage name, and that's what his legal name is now.
His name is rich and famous. Does he have a last name?
It's just Rich is the first name. Famous is the last name, and is the middle initial.
What does he do?
Well, I was getting to that.
Okay, yeah, you've intrigued me here. This is I've never heard this before. Go ahead.
One of the things he has is sort of this website and Facebook page he's created. It's called BIBT, Because Your Body Belongs to You. And it's he keeps track of stories about organ donations and transplants, and specifically the market for organs, because it's illegal to sell your organs.
Yeah.
As, you know, you're not allowed to make a individual decision to sell your organs either before or after you die. And you know, but what is happening is that people donate their organs voluntarily, and then what happens is the hospital takes those organs, and there's these intermediary organizations that profit. Or they're supposedly nonprofit, but you know, people are working for these organizations, making their living at it, you know. So, and of course, the person receiving the organ is paying. they're definitely paying tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars to get this organ. And so someone's making all this money, and it's going through the nonprofit organizations and the hospitals, and there's all these middlemen profiting from it. You, the person whose guts are being used, are not allowed to profit from it, and your family can't profit from it. Well, so my father's opinion is that that's wrong, and you should be allowed to. And I thought that was very interesting, because if you think about it, this could be the source of derivatives now and in the future. You can have investments based on this. You know, you could, because my dad's idea is that you should be allowed to use your body as a resource. You should be able to find a company that wants to buy it and make a contract with them that, you know, they can have your organs after you die. And of course, you know, they'll probably assess your health and give you a rating of the value of your organs based
interesting
on
yeah
your lifestyle and everything. At any rate, so yeah, I was saying that not only could this be great for the people, for individuals, if this law was changed so that we all would have on average, about $150,000 worth of organs in our body that we could borrow against. But you know, if I've thought of it, probably someone else has too. So let's connect this to Obamacare.
Uh-oh.
All right. No, seriously, the Obamacare is at heart. Really, it's all about taking the assumption that your body belongs to you. It's the last frontier. It's the one thing that the government hasn't claimed complete ownership of yet.
Yeah.
And they're going to take that as well. And if you think about it, what else does the United States government have to offer its bondholders anymore? Because they've already, as I think I explained maybe in our last conversation, they already hypothecated all of the land and other property to the bondholders, whoever the obligés are of,
right,
of our national debt. In 1933, they actually, Congress did that.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
And so it literally, ever since then, the land beneath your feet and everything that anyone thinks they own in the United States is actually owned by bankers. The government said so. But the only thing, and also, of course, the fruit of your labor, anything that you might do in your life to create wealth, it also already belongs to these bankers. The one thing that they don't own yet is your physical body. And if you think about it, we now are in a position where if we're going to restructure our debt, we will have to offer another collateral of some sort. And if we're going to reinflate the economy, we need to have another bubble, another commodity that you can base derivatives on. So I absolutely thought, you know, that this was the direction they were going in. Now, obviously, it looks like Obamacare is dead in the water for now, but I still think that this is the final frontier of debt slavery.
Wow. Well, I hope it doesn't happen for a while, Tracy, because I smoke, I drink too much. My body's worthless. My body's worthless. I'm in better shape. I'm in better shape if we just stick with this dying dollar. Wow.
Yeah, no doubt.
Very interesting. That is very interesting. Wow. So you see, this is something that may happen. I just would like to think that at some point the human race will figure out that this like economic system, you know, that we can stop this before they institute the new bubble, that we wake up to this whole thing. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't understand why, you know, we just, I just don't understand why we can't seem to get ourselves out of this mess. Do you know what I mean? I think people are just powerless and they just don't want to do anything about it, and they've been conditioned, you know, dumbed down and pushed out of the whole, you know, decision-making process about the world.
Yeah, yeah, for the most part, that's true. But you don't have to have everyone involved in a revolution, you know. It's really just a fraction of the people that,
right,
that do that when you look through history. And of course, that's what I think is going on. I think we are going from one era to another. People are waking up. There's going to be a revolution. One generation will supplant the previous one. And you can think of it as analogous to Zeus overthrowing Cronos or Cronos overthrowing Uranus. It's the way that one age passes to the next, and the oppressed youth, the slaves, overtake their masters. But what I talked about in Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, I said that any system, just historically, it always has to have someone play the role of the sacrifice and the victim. So if a new age is going to come, and some other concept to rule, even if it's not a literal elite or a new ruler, you know, if it's the golden age, then it should be some sort of system of anarchy. Or if we have a ruler, then it should be an unruler. You know, he should be the lord of misrule. We should he should be a ruler in name only. But you know, even the golden age had its victim, its slave that they used as the source of their sustenance and as the sort of scapegoat upon which the sins of the ruling elite would sort of put the blame for everything. And, you know, I don't think that's ever going to change. I'm sure that there will be a new scapegoat in the future.
Well, yeah. Well, isn't that's kind of the concern I had too reading the book. How do we know that? We've kind of established here that the system that's in place has been engineered by people. How do we know that they're just not trying to engineer their own golden age for themselves and wear the put upon slaves to produce their golden age?
Well, we don't know that at all.
I mean, isn't that what actually is happening? Possibly.
Well, I think that's what they think, but. You know, Cronos always thought that he was going to rule, and he thought of everything. He didn't realize that Rhea had tricked him. You know, I think that that's the way it is here too. You know, these people think they have everything under control, but always historically something slips out of their notice, and that's the thing that leads to their downfall and the creation of the next age. But you know, Zeus was the son of Cronos. And that's likely to be the case here as well. If there's going to be a new form of leadership, then the leaders of that new new government or whatever it is will come from the same bloodlines, most likely.
That doesn't sound good, though.
Well, I don't think there's a, you know, like I said, there's something, we're talking about something that's bigger than us.
I think that
you know, a lot of what people say is you know, conspiracy of elite families throughout generations. Sometimes it's just fate and destiny that, you know, I think that these people literally have, you know, they have curses and blessings from previous generations stored in their DNA. You know, that's how it works. I don't think that they can stop being what they are.
Right, right. So it's not so much like, because people always talk about how, you know, if there's this grand conspiracy, why would someone put all their life's work into something that they'll never even see the fruition of? You know, like, you know, people who are working towards a one-world government. You know, if they were working on it in the 40s or something like that, they wouldn't even see it come to fruition. But what you're saying is sort of like that it's just sort of destiny. It's just sort of this pattern that's emerging.
Well, see, that's the concept of the Lord of the Earth in the center of the Earth that I alluded to a little bit in Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge. If you go to my website, TracyRToyman.com, you'll find a new article that gets into this much, much deeper. It's called Regnum in Potentia, Saturn's kingdom transformed into the Golden Age. And it's all about this concept of the Lord of the Earth. There were a lot of like Eastern cults that were into this idea too, and the Nazis were into it. This is their idea of the black sun in the center of the earth. The swastika was actually a symbol of this black sun concept. They were saying that there's this god buried in the center of the earth who's really the lord of the earth, even though you can't see him, and he's controlling everything in some mystical manner. He's actually asleep, and his dreams are controlling our reality. We're living within his dream, and we're being sort of subtly controlled by him through unseen forces. And the control mechanism he's really using is the people in positions of power on Earth, that he's manipulating them. But the reason why he's able to tap into their consciousness and manipulate them so easily is because they're his children. And this Lord of the Earth is Saturn. It's what happened to Saturn or Cronos after he was overthrown. He was imprisoned in this subterranean chamber. And the story goes that in this subterranean chamber, there's this hidden sun, the central sun or the black sun, an artificial sun. And in some instances, it seems like they're saying Saturn is the black sun. It's the same thing. So the black sun that the Nazis believed in was this hidden power that animated things on the surface. They sort of thought of it as the source of the electromagnetic field. And everything on Earth is sort of being subtly manipulated by the power of the black sun and what they called the green ray, the energy that comes from the black sun.
Yeah.
You were saying, okay, well, why are these people doing things in some sort of grand scheme that they're only in their lives? And, well, it's because that, you know, they're really tapping into something larger than themselves, being controlled by something larger than themselves. And then, of course, some of them are actually members of secret societies that do occult rituals where they contact hidden entities. And the Nazis, for instance, were literally, or some of this, I guess, to specify, some of the secret societies that sort of spawned the Nazi movement. They were literally channeling messages from beings that they believed to be living in the center of the earth. And they gave them directions on how to build flying saucers and stuff. But, you know, so if Nazis were doing things like that, or the progenitors of the Nazis were doing things like that, isn't it possible that there's some Masonic lodges that are doing things like that? And the attendants at those Masonic lodges are people in positions of power, you know? I think that that's quite possible.
Yeah.
Economy's been a little rough, man.
Oh, man, just brutal.
You know, it's times like these that E-Trade can really help you replan your investments. Yep. So, you know, it gives you the tools and research. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Take control. Rise up.
Dude, broken.
No.
What?
Stop.
What, I can't flex the golden pipes?
It's not the venue.
It's inspiration.
Any place.
Fine.
Okay, where was I?
I'm going to fly again.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
No, I'm just poking at your funny bone. I am quite alarmed.
I don't think you realize the danger. Like the people who think it's okay to bring shampoo on an airplane.